favorite descriptions of the church. It's in a passage in which Paul describes how he views the apostles' work and the work of the brethren in the church. And it's a really, really revealing passage, I think. It tells a lot about how, you know, the apostles saw themselves, and especially how they saw each other, which means that we should see each other sort of the same way. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul described the church this way, and actually it's part of a longer description, but verse 9 is the part that I like so much. So, for we are God's fellow workers. There's been a little bit of debate about whether that means just the apostles. You know, just the apostles were God's fellow workers, and there's some legitimacy to that. They had the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, whereas not every Christian does, and no Christians today do. But on the other hand, we do work for the same goal, you know, salvation for mankind. So there's some legitimacy to both sides, whether it was just talking about the apostles or talking about Christians, you know, in general. But he says, we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field and God's building. And one of the reasons that I love that description is because, for one, you've got God's building, which most people would say is the building that we all sit in, which we know is not true. You know, God's building is the church. It's made up of the stones that are built on the human heart, the foundation of the gospel, and that foundation is Christ. It's made up of the seed that is sown in the fertile ground, which, again, is the human heart, the parable of the sower. Which is why I also love the description of the church as God's field. You know, Christians is God's field, right? Because we're the people that have the hearts on whom the seed fell, and the good heart made it able to grow, and we can continue studying and continue growing, and that describes a person who continues living after Christ. And together, we're not just individual plants. You know, we're not just blades of grass, but we are the field of God. And when you think about a field, you know, there's a lot that goes into raising crops. My experience with this subject, by the way, ends at citrus, because that's all that I had any experience with in Florida. But, it has a lot to do with raising crops. If you want to grow plants in a field, it takes some maintenance. It takes some work. And one of the things that Paul is pointing out here, I think, would be just as relevant to congregations like Main Street today. That's one of the reasons I love worshiping at Main Street, is because here we have excellent examples of people. I won't mention names specifically, but like people, I've never heard this particular person say a negative thing or discourage anybody or gossip. Even when they've asked for like requests for prayer for difficult things, they've always ended with a word of encouragement. You know, something like, "I know God's going to take care of it. It's gonna be okay." That kind of person. That was some of the people in Corinth. You know, I know the elders and their wives here have taken time to take care of some Christians who need taken care of, to study with people who need studying with teaching. Those kinds of people were at Corinth. The deacons do an awesome job. I personally see and experience the deacons, you know, serving people's tables, putting food on people's tables, and serving the congregation. And there were people like that at Corinth, you know. And on top of that, there were people just like other people here. People who took much, much, much of their own time and money. I'm thinking of three specifically who were dedicated encouragers, Barnabases. And, you know, some of the things we don't always realize about those people is when the church is really struggling with something, a lot of times it falls back on those encouragers. And they're doing things that not everybody sees, not everybody knows about, but really they're kind of propping up the church while it struggles or has a problem. Great, great gratitude for those of you who do those things. In fact, I won't mention a name, but very soon after we moved here, someone very specifically took us to a bakery. And I remember thinking about this trip to the bakery, and I was like, I love that bakery. And I got home, and I was like, why do I love that bakery so much? It's just, you know, flour, sugar, and eggs like any other bakery. But what made it my favorite bakery was the good time we had at that bakery, you know, being encouraged by our brother or sister in Christ. Again, keep it anonymous, brother or sister. But it was a great blessing. And that's the kind of people who were at Corinth. The kind of people who were building, the kind of people who were growing. And that's part of what Paul, because I suspect that Paul wrote Hebrews, but we don't really know for sure. So that's part of what the writer of Hebrews was getting at in chapter 12. So Hebrews 11 and 12 are passages that, I guess I'll just own it, I preach about a lot. But I realized I don't often preach about the second half of Hebrews chapter 12. Because Hebrews 11 is this incredibly encouraging passage, this great hall of faith, you know, all of these incredible people who did incredible things by faith. And chapter 12 opens up with this key principle to being a Christian, which is also incredibly encouraging. Therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. You know, if you want to continue to be a Christian, if you want to grow, then looking to Jesus is the way to look. I love that he writes about Jesus as suffering so much and yet being so joyful to sit at the right hand of the throne of God. Because Christians, we suffer, although most of us not even a fraction of what Christ did. But we have the same perspective. We're going to get through this and we're going to spend eternity with God. And he kind of turns this into a discussion of discipline. You know, if God disciplined Jesus, his son, then we should understand God's discipline and be grateful for it. In fact, he goes on to speak about this discipline, this suffering, to say in verse 12, this is what's on the board, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. It's very encouraging. The writer is saying, essentially, even in the bad things that happen in life, we can find encouragement from God. Even from the discipline that our Father puts on us, we can find it. And when you think about our topic this morning and Wednesday nights in Bible class, if Israel had taken that discipline of God's well, it would be a very different story to the Old Testament. But instead, they continually forsook the Lord, and when things were bad, they would eventually kind of get back to crying out to him, but ultimately, they never could quite get there. And even throughout the Gospels and Acts, still struggled with God's discipline of the Israelite nation and with people who don't follow him in general. So strive for that peace. What a great outcome of that kind of life. You know, peace and holiness. That's God's field, right? That's God's fertile ground. That's the place the seed is sown and growth happens. But there is a problem when you try to raise crops in a field, and that is specifically disease. You know, I think this was last week. I used orange trees as an example, too, so you'll have to pardon me for doubling up on it. But you know, in Florida, we had a couple years. This happened twice that I can remember, where, like, everybody was cutting down their orange trees. And a lot of people had several orange trees, and they'd have to just cut them down, get rid of the stumps, and then go plant all new orange trees, which was significantly troublesome because some of those trees had been there as long as those people had lived in that home. You know, trees take a little while to grow. And while you can buy a new tree and it'll start bearing fruit pretty quickly, it's still not the same. It's not like going out in your yard and looking at the tree you climbed up in to grab oranges as a kid. And the reason that this happened is because these 2 years specifically, trees got diseased. But my granddaddy was explaining to me one time, he said, if a tree has a disease in a branch, you can cut off a branch and maybe save the tree if you catch it before it spreads. If it has a disease in the fruit, you can get rid of the fruit, you know, and maybe the next season it'll bear good fruit. But if the disease is in the root, the tree's gone. There's no way to save it. You can cut off as many branches as you want. You can take off all the fruit. But as long as that disease is in that root, it will continue to disease the rest of the tree. And what had happened was some of that stock in those hybrid trees had come from diseased ground or something, and it had diseased all the trees that were, you know, planted on that stock. And so all of these trees had to be taken out and replaced. And on top of that, they were spreading it to other trees too, which was not good. Look at what the writer of Hebrews wrote in verse 15. Right after all of this encouragement, all of this goal setting, verse 15, see to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled, that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears. This root of bitterness, Paul said, could ruin it all. Much like much like one of those orange trees and their diseased roots, this root of bitterness could spread a great deal of disease to other trees, cause a lot of damage in the field of the Lord. This is problematic for obvious reasons. But it's also problematic because when it's a root of bitterness, right, it's not just a branch or it's not just a fruit. Sometimes we think, well, if we handle a bitter person, whether we can correct them and teach them or whether we have to cut them off, if we can handle a bitter person, then the problem is solved. But if the root is deeper than the person, then the problem can still persist and still cause a great deal of disease. And I think it's so almost weird the way that Esau is used as an example here. And we're going to look at Esau this morning. But look at what he says there in verse 16. See that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright. Now, when we think about Esau, we almost always think immediately about the fact he was super hairy and probably red hair, you know, had red hair, and that he sold his birthright for a bowl of soup, which I think today many of us would be like, that's just completely foolish. At the time, it was pretty foolish, too. So why does he list this, you know, no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau? What is it about sexual immorality? What is it that unholiness, that matches up with the root of bitterness, with the terrible trouble that's caused, with the defilement that's caused, with selling one's birthright? What is it about this kind of thing? This may be a reference to the fact that Esau, against his parents' wishes, married women who did not come from his family and did not share, you know, faith in God. And we read that it caused a lot of bitterness in his family. And we see that kind of thing today, too. You know, raise your hand if you've ever seen a marriage cause some bitterness in a family. Yeah, funny how that works, you know. So that was essentially one of the things that Esau did. It may be that he was engaging in sexual immorality with these women and then marrying them, or maybe marrying them and doing both. And that was what was causing bitterness in his family. But there's more to that birthright and bitterness that was going on with Esau. I was kind of surprised to see that the idea of the root of bitterness is actually from Deuteronomy. If you look at Deuteronomy 29, I put a sort of selection up there on the board, but I'll just so we kind of understand what's going on here, I'm going to read a little bit. So in Deuteronomy 29, Moses is kind of giving one of those summary sermons, telling Israel, like, you've seen all of this good stuff, so remember it. And this is how verse 2 begins. Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "You have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh, to all his servants and all his land, the great trials that your eyes saw, the signs and the great wonders." I want to pause there for just a minute. Do you remember Hebrews 11? We have so great a cloud of many witnesses. You have seen all these great witnesses. And then chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, even despite the hardships, right? Despite the punishment, the discipline, the things we suffer. You know, verse 2 here says, Moses said, "You've seen all those examples. You have all those witnesses," literally a cloud of witness that they followed in the wilderness. Then in verse 3, "You've experienced great trials," you know, a great discipline and great miracles. There was both of that mixed in there. And so you probably wouldn't be surprised that in verses 4 through 9, Moses is making the same point to the Israelites that the writer of Hebrews is making to Christians, which is, be strong in your faith, you know. Moses kind of makes it the opposite way. The Lord has not given you this heart, so go get it, you know, have this heart. But it's the same encouragement, be strong in your faith. And he goes on throughout the chapter, not just to make that point, but also to say that God had been doing all of this for his plan, that they have this land. And this is in verse 16. Moses had described that they came out of Egypt, and they went through these nations whom God had previously told Abraham their wickedness was not complete. He couldn't live there until they were wicked enough that God kicked them out. And then Moses described that in verse 16. "You know how we lived in the land of Egypt and how we came through the midst of the nations through which you passed. And you have seen their detestable things, their idols of wood and stone, of silver and gold, which were among them. Beware lest there be among you a man or woman or clan or tribe whose heart is turning away today from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of those nations. Beware lest there be among you a root bearing poisonous and bitter fruit. So, certainly, Achan was one such root, bearing poisonous and bitter fruit. He'd heard the commandment of God just like anybody. He knew what was supposed to happen to the goods of Jericho just like everybody else in the camp. But he took one. And to say he was a root of bitterness is an understatement. Many of his fellow countrymen died, and they could not continue their conquest of Canaan as long as that sin was in the camp. It was certainly a root of bitterness, wasn't it? But the problem did not start with Achan doing a thing. In Achan's own words, "I saw, I coveted, I took, I hid." Do you see where the theft began? It began, "I saw, I coveted." That's a heart thing. And in Deuteronomy, as Moses uses this very strong image of a root that poisons and makes bitter the entire tree, he said, "Beware lest any among you, man or woman, clan or tribe, whose heart is turning away from the Lord." If you look in verse 19, this is reemphasized in one who, when he hears the words of this sworn covenant, blesses himself in his heart, saying, "I shall be safe, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart." This will lead to a sweeping away of moist and dry alike. His heart is the problem here. And see, the issue with thinking, "Well, I can cut off the branch and save the whole tree and not do anything else," is that our hearts influence each other. You know? If, let's say, Achan's sin had not gone addressed, maybe let's say God had let them get away with it. If you've been a parent and you have, you know, children, and you've let them get away with something that they're not supposed to get away with, you know what happens. It amplifies in the future. And eventually, at some point, they wind up doing something that is so bad that you either lose control of it, or you have to come in and really come down hard, and you have to do 10 times worse discipline than you were trying to avoid, you know, in the first place. And if Achan had gotten away with seeing and coveting and stealing and hiding, then which of his brethren, seeing that, would be influenced to do it? And then if you go back and you get rid of Achan, how much does it matter? The camp, as the disease has already spread. And so God literally says, if this happens, I'll sweep the whole thing away, like those orange trees in Florida. Look at verse 27, skipping a little bit just for time's sake. "Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against this land, bringing upon it all the curses written in the book, and the Lord uprooted them," that's the Philistines, "from their land in anger and fury and great wrath, and cast them into another land as they are to this day." The thing I find so amazing about what Moses is telling Israel here is he's saying, "You guys get this great land. It's going to be awesome. In fact, God has chased out all these wicked, evil, bad Philistines for all of their idol worship so that you can have this land, and you're going to cast them out and scatter them." And then Israel went and fell right into idol worship that was as bad or worse. And so God brought in the Babylonians and the Assyrians, and they took out the Israelites and swept them out of the land and scattered them everywhere else. So big picture, this idolatry, this heart sin, was so firmly rooted that even sweeping away a whole generation of trees, so to speak, didn't stop the disease. And the Israelites wound up being poisoned by the same thing, which, you know, we've said this before, but we walk into each other's houses and we don't see, you know, shrines and figurines and prayers and sacrifices, but we still understand that the thing that idolatry is not the image. The thing that idolatry is that description of the person who says, there in verse 19, "I shall be safe though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart." You see, that person might not be Achan hiding idols under his tent. But that person is saying, "I know that there's something I need to do, but I have these reasons for not doing it. And because I have those reasons, I'm going to be okay." You know? "I know there's something that is right, but honestly, in my situation, it's not right for me. You know, my heart is telling me to do something else." And we all know that we should follow our hearts, right? Unless our hearts are poisoned. Right? Should a tree follow its roots if its roots are full of disease? if we follow that self before God, my heart, what it is telling me, as opposed to what God is, then why would we expect anything other than to be swept away? Which brings us to chapter 11 of Hebrews. Look at the difference here very briefly between these examples of faith, and we'll talk about Esau in just a minute. So Hebrews 11, just to in brief review, verse 17 says quite a bit about Abraham, but look at this. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, "Through Isaac shall your offspring be named." He considered that God was even able to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. We're going to move on to verse 20 in just a minute. But Abraham offered up Isaac. Could you imagine being told, "You're going to have to sacrifice your child for me, for God"? I don't know if I could do it. Honestly, at this point, I don't think I could do it. I don't think I could. To do it would require that I make a decision that my heart and my child and me be less important than this word that God has given, which makes no sense anyway. You know, never since or after has God required child sacrifice. In fact, he stated he hates it. And luckily, at that point, he did not require child sacrifice either. But Abraham had the kind of faith that said, God said to do it, I'm going to do it because he can raise Isaac from the dead anyway. If he's promised that Isaac is going to be the promised child, then that's what's going to happen. What a pure, faithful heart. You go on to look at Isaac, how Isaac invoked blessings. When he was dying, he blessed his children. And a blessing, especially the kind of blessing that Isaac exercised, was one that required faith. Verse 22 says, by faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. Could you imagine, like, dying and saying, like, I'm going to be buried in China when my whole family lives in China? I don't know that there's any reason that my whole family is ever going to move to China. What would be amazing is if that happened and came true. That's the kind of faith that Joseph had. He knew they were going back, and he knew that when they went back, that's where his bones would be, at home. Now look at this compared to Esau. Look at that kind of faith compared to this guy, Esau, in Genesis 25, 23. I'm going to move through the text here just for time's sake, but Esau and Jacob were born in conflict, and that conflict was part of God's plan. Before they were even born, in Genesis 25, 23, God prophesied that the younger would rule the older, and that the older would be in subjection to him. In verse 27, there was conflict in the family. You know, Isaac had his favorite child, Esau, because he enjoyed the food he made, and Rebekah had her favorite child, Jacob, who was something of a keeper of tents, you know, who kind of worked at home. So they had their favorites. And again, talk about a root of bitterness in the family. I don't know if any of you have ever seen a family with favorite children not experience bitterness. You know, that's a pretty bitter situation in families. So it didn't exactly cause peace in their family either. Jacob specifically put Esau's birthright in his scope. In verse 29, when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in the field and from the field, and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore, his name was called Edom. And Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." So birthrights were an ancient tradition. I was kind of surprised they didn't actually start with Israel. In Genesis 15 and verse 2, God tells Abraham he's going to have this great nation. And Abraham's response was, well, Eliezer of Damascus is going to be my offspring. He's going to be the one who takes care of my house after I'm gone. Because this tradition was already going on at the time. By the time Abraham had left Ur of the Chaldees, he realized he needed someone to pass down his stuff to. In chapter 26, Laban said, essentially, your tradition for birthrights is different from ours, which means that foreign land was already practicing, you know, the rights of the firstborn. Laban specifically said, it wouldn't be right for me to give my secondborn away before my firstborn. It's not the way we do it here. So it was being done a long, long time, this practice of distributing the goods of a dead person. That's what a birthright is. It's distributing the power over the family, the property, and the goods of someone who has died. Now, I want us to think about that for just a minute before we move on, because what good does a dead person's good do for you? You know, the reason that we save for our offspring, I'm doing it. The reason I'm saving it for Chloe and trying to prepare for it is because I want good things for her. And when I die, I have no idea what's going to happen, so I want her to have some resources, right? But if all I do is save money and don't bring her to the gospel, what good have my goods done for my daughter? You know? And if you are saved, and there's a fight about the goods of a dead man, you already have heaven. This position that Esau was in was so sinful because he took something so valuable and valued it so little. And not in the right way. Esau didn't say, I have my eyes set on God. He said, I have my eyes set on my stomach. Right? Some of your birthright now. And Esau said, I'm about to die. Of what use is the birthright to me? I assume he had walked into camp, and I assume his mother would have made him a meal if no one else would. You know, it'd be hard for me to imagine him coming in hungry and Rebecca going, nope. Jacob says, swear to me now. So he swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. And so in verse 34, Jacob kept up his end of the deal, just in case you were worried, and he gave him the stew and the bread that he'd asked for. What is it doing? What was Esau doing when he put the stew over his inheritance? He was idolizing the soup. And you know, we use the word idolize ironically because most of the time we idolize things that aren't worthy of worship. Is a bowl of soup worthy of worship? I mean, he does make a good potato soup. But no, you won't come into our home and find it on a shrine. You know? So Jacob gave Esau his end, and Esau despised, he disdained, he looked down on this very valuable thing. And that was the heart condition of the root of bitterness that caused pain in his family for the rest of their lives. And when we think about this for families today, you know, think about how this applies. Do parents have problems that don't get addressed aside from like passive-aggressive comments around the dinner table? When those kinds of things happen, when we can't put aside our pride or being right or wrong, what does it sow in our children? A root of bitterness or a stable raising in Christ? You know, do children sometimes get into danger, like drug use, maybe like sexual immorality, and parents don't address it because maybe we did the same things when we were kids. Maybe we have shame about them. Maybe we don't know how to address them. Or, you know, honestly, maybe we just figure that's just part of growing up. What kind of problem, kind of root does that sow? Sowing wild oats. It's not just part of growing up. It's a root of bitterness that we don't always see. And when we apply it to Christians, too, because I think that's where the real application is, in congregations, do we gossip? One word, it's just a tiny thing. You know? It may be just a tiny thing. It might be true. What effect does it have on our brethren? Well, this happens a lot in small towns. I've seen it happen here. You know, do families have problems between them that wind up for decades derailing growth in a community of God's church? I'd definitely say that happens. Many people here probably knows of situations in which that has happened. And I've seen all across, like, I guess half of the country, I haven't really been all across, but I've seen congregations split and divide and not get back together over issues. Sometimes they'll even go, well, that's a scriptural issue. But more often than not, it's actually a question came up, and then people stopped acting like Christians. And because somebody got offended or hurt and couldn't take it like a Christian, people chose sides, and then it stopped being so much a scriptural issue as a personal one that had a Bible verse to back it up. And then you got decades later, division between brethren who still get offended and still have bitterness and still don't get along. See, an idolatrous heart would look at those things and say, that's what I'm doing. I know something's wrong. I know I should be doing something right. I know I should study this out and open my heart and my mind, and I should do better here. But I'm right. You know? But I was taught. I was taught this, and that's right. And besides, they're never going to change. Anyway. Is that a heart of faith? I think you see where Deuteronomy 29:19 comes into that. I shall be safe, though I walk and the stubbornness of my heart. I wish I could say I was free from that temptation, but I think, brethren, you know better. No, I am not, and no one is. That choice between self over God. And if you'll give me just one more minute of your time, look at Hebrews 12 again, verse 22. This is the heart of faith. So all of that's the root of bitterness that we need to make sure does not spring up in the field, in God's field. But this is the root of faith. And I think you won't be surprised to find out that it is an inheritance, a birthright that is worth everything. You have come, verse 22 of Hebrews 12 says, to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, innumerable angels and festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Compare Christ's covenant to Jacob's. Esau got a bowl of stew for his birthright. Jacob gave up a bowl of stew for his inheritance. What we have to give up for our birthright is the selfish things that harden our hearts and make us stubborn. Confessing sin and repenting of it, being baptized, is that much? Is that a high cost for our soul or our inheritance? We have come to this incredible assembly, verse 23, of the firstborn. All of us are of the firstborn, no matter where we were born or how many people are in our family or who we are. All of us have come to this incredible assembly of the firstborn, and all of us have ample opportunity to accept a covenant far better than stew and money. And this morning, if you're here and there's anything that you need to do to accept that covenant, then please let us know, and we'd love to help as we stand and sing.